Blog Talk Radio.
Ooh. Yeah, yeah. You already know what time it is. It's that official time. When we take this worldwide. Let's go. Listen. So now it's time to turn it up. Surf the radio waves as we begin to burn it up. We all up in your area like landscape, definitely bringing you the power slamming pancakes. It's the mandate that you tune in. It's time to move out so we can move in and recognize that this is no illusion. I'm here to clear the air so that there is no confusion. It all started off in the book of Genesis when Jacob was wrestling with who he thought was his nemesis. And when the man saw he couldn't overpower him, he touched his hip but he really could have devoured him. And from that point then we hear a name change, rearrange the game, so now we gotta change. So I'm here to let you know it's time to listen to the Pancake and Power Slam Show. Let's go!
Turn it up, turn it up. It's the Pancake and Power Slam.
Turn it up, turn it up.
It's the Pancake and Power Slam.
Turn it up, turn it up.
It's the Pancake and Power Slam Show.
Turn it up, turn it up.
It's the Pancake and Power Slam.
Turn it up, turn it up.
It's the Pancake and Power Slam.
Turn it up, turn it up.
It's the Pancake and Power Slam Show.
Turn it up.
You are now listening to the Pancakes and Power Slam Show by Crave Wrestling on Blog Talk Radio. Be sure to follow Crave Wrestling on Twitter at Crave Wrestling and join the Facebook fan page Crave Wrestling.
Episode 214, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Pancakes and Power Slam Show. As always, I am Chris Featherstone, your host. And we're going to have some fun, amazing, amazing time at episode 214. So let's get to it. I mean, we got some fun. I tell you what, I say this all the time. Absolutely love the support that we have, the Pancakes and Power Slam Show. Absolutely love just the fun and excitement that we have every single week. And I've had so many interviews on this show, and I look forward to every single interview. I just love speaking to pro wrestlers about just their thoughts on the business and just their personal experience. But it's just something that just makes me so just warm and fuzzy inside when I speak to someone who's had so much tenure and so much history within the business of professional wrestling, that I can just sit back, give me some tea and some crumpets, and just listen to road story after road story. Ladies and gentlemen, tonight will not fail you in that. So without further ado, we have former AWA World Tag Team Champion, none other than the superstar, Bill Dundee. How are you tonight, sir?
Chris, I'm doing good. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. It's great to speak with you tonight.
You too.
Awesome. So how's your day been? Did you have anything specifically, other than right now, have anything specifically on your agenda for today? Did you just relax?
No, we started off raining in the morning, and it got nicer as the day went on. I went to the gym, worked out, and then I came home and didn't really do nothing, just loafed around waiting on tonight.
Yeah, awesome. So how's your workout routine these days? I know that conditioning was so – strength and conditioning is something that a lot of people don't understand how much – is important to have in the wrestling business. How's your workouts nowadays?
Well, there's no heavy weights no more. I use a whole lot lighter weights, and I ride my bike and things like that. So the conditioning part, I'm not trying to be big and strong no more. I used to try to bench press 300 pounds. Now I'm lucky if I can do 100 pounds, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So how was it back then? I know that, you know, you had some really good trainers becoming a pro wrestler. How rigorous was the training back when you started?
Well, I started off as a kid. I was kind of like Ronda Rousey in the MMA. I started off in judo. My uncle had a judo school in Scotland. When I was 12, I started off doing judo, and I did that when I was about 16. And it was the same thing, the air conditioning. You had to be in shape and all that. Then I used to watch wrestling on Adrian Streets and Billy Robertson, and all them guys were wrestling on English TV when I lived in Scotland. It would come on Saturday afternoon, and I would watch them. They were all younger.
Yeah.
And then I went to my uncle's judo school, and there was two guys working out, and he said, they're professional wrestlers. And I thought, they are? So I watched them, and I thought, well, I can whoop any one of them. So it's in my head, but anyway. I went up and talked to them and said, well, you're really too small to be a wrestler. But they weren't giants either. They were maybe 210 pounds. I was 5'7" and 180 pounds. But anyway, it was good for the judo, and that's how I got my first talk to a professional wrestler there when I moved to Australia.
Yeah.
I moved
yeah.
in about next door to a guy that had a unarmed combat school. He taught you how to fight with a knife and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I went there and learned and was doing that, and I saw a poster on the wall, and it was him and his brother was wrestler. Professional. I said, you're a professional wrestler? He said, yeah. I said, would you teach me to do that? He said, Bill, I think you're a little small. I said, well, I can't get no taller, but I'll get thicker. So I started lifting heavy weights and squatting and doing all the things to put weight on. So I got from 180 pounds up to about 205, and I thought I was a giant then. So a guy by the name of Hal Morgan used to run the club circuit up there. So we worked for him, and then I met George Barnes, and then Jim Barnett came to from when he hit Atlanta wrestling, but he brought it to Australia, and he just called it championship wrestling. So he liked me and Barnes, so we worked for him. Then they brought Bobby Shane over. He was the booker, and he says, you guys need to go to Tennessee. You're about the right size. They'd like you there. So he got in touch with Jerry Jarrett, and the rest is history. Here we are, 1975. We arrived in Nashville, Tennessee, and we got over real good. The first month I was in town, we were selling at Memphis, so we got going real good as a heel tag team. And George got homesick, went home. I stayed. They switched me to a good guy, and here we are.
Wow. So what was it about wrestling that you knew that this was it for you? This was... Was this, you know, it just kind of, it seemed like it just kind of fell in your lap as far as just the career is concerned. Now,
right.
What, you know, how that, you, I mean, it was a great story that you just explained. But, you know, how, what was it about wrestling that really compelled you to know that this is it for me?
You didn't have to worry about anybody else.
Yeah.
And the same as judo, it was you against the other guy. One-on-one, you didn't have to worry about 10 teammates doing their part so your team could win. You was your own team. One-on-one, I like one-on-one stuff. So I didn't worry about 9 other guys having to help me win a ball game. I would just go out there and do my judo thing and win. And I got amateur wrestling, I'd do that too. So the one-on-one, I think it was. And that way you can go and do your own thing by yourself. You don't have to worry about nobody else.
Yeah. Now, you were in your 30s.
For me.
Yeah. You were in your 30s when you came to the States, right?
32. Looked 18.
Wow. So what made you come to the States? Better opportunity?
Yeah, Jerry Jarrett got his book. Well, Bobby Shane called Jerry Jarrett on the phone from Australia, and he got his book here, and we came to Nashville to work for Nick Goulis. Well, that's another story. Old Nick, he was not here no more, but you don't want to talk about people that ain't here to defend themselves, but Nick was like the old-time promoters. He'd tell you one thing and do another, but Jared was the booker, so he liked us, looked after us. We made money in Memphis. We sold out about the fourth week we was in, and it was real, you know, good. So it was good for me from the start. I can't knock nothing about it, but Jerry Jarrett was the booker, and he was the one that looked after me and Barnes, and we didn't have much to do with Nick. And then they split, and then Nick went out of business, and Jarrett took over the whole thing.
Yeah, that's awesome. So, you did get a pretty good break right soon within Memphis Wrestling, and especially in the AWA. So, how did your partnership with Jared in the Memphis territory allow you to get a break in the AWA?
Well, Lawler kind of... the South was NWA, that was then National Wrestling Alliance, and that you had to use their champion. Well, Jerry Jarrett made a deal with, like, went up there and he knew Gagne and Nick Bockwinkel. I thought Nick Bockwinkel was a better champion than Ric Flair, so, I mean, that was food. Nick had was a more class act than all, I thought. And we got hooked up with AWA so that we brought Nick in. And Lawler wrestled him a couple of times for the AWA belt. I worked against him. So then when it came time for the tag team, Lawler and I went up there and they put the belts on us, and we were the AWA tag team champs for a while. So that's how that all came about. Jerry Jarrett made an alliance with the AWA and not the NWA, and that's what we used in Memphis.
Yeah, how was it working with Jerry?
Jerry Lawler or Jerry Jarrett?
Jerry Lawler.
Oh, working with Lawler, but there's nobody does it better than me and Lawler. There's no other two people who've been in with the same territory that's wrestled one another for 30 years and sold that more times than me and Jerry Lawler. Nobody. You can't name me two people that did it.
Yeah, it was...
except me and Lawler. Now, Flair and Steamboat, they said, had a good run over in the Carolinas, but I wasn't there. I never saw none of that, but it didn't go 30 years either.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, you and Lawler definitely made some big noise in the AWA territory. So,
it was another thing. I mean, Lawler and me never hung around together. We didn't go out together. We didn't do nothing together. We was just a good business arrangement, either a tag team or against one another. And the people bought into the story, and it was that we didn't particularly care for one another. You're right, we didn't break bread every day. He didn't come to my house, and I didn't go to his. But respect-wise, in the wrestling ring, we had that for each other, and that's what it takes to draw money and make money.
Yeah. Who'd you usually travel with on the road?
Well, I worked in an office, so Jerry Jarrett and Eddie Marlin was the office. So if you're the booker or the assistant booker, or you're helping in the office, or you're putting stuff together, you don't ride with the boys, you ride with the office. So Jerry Jarrett and Eddie Marlin and me would go to Memphis together, Louisville together, and if need be, I'd go by myself. So just, you know, but most of the time, you know, you'd like somebody, you'd get along. Tommy Rich and I got along good together. When Tommy was in here, I rode with Tommy. So, you know, just because you're in the same business, that don't mean you're going to live with everybody or just ride with them, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Wildfire Tommy Rich, that's a blast from the past. So how was it working with
Tommy
Rich?
The past. Now, that boy was over like Rover when he first started, 18 years old, big old boy, he's about 6'2", 240 pounds, blonde hair. Thought he was second coming. So, anyway, he did good, and then him and I was tagged up, and we had a lot of fun together. Then he went off to Atlanta and worked for Barnett. Then he came back, and he was in and out both places. So, Tommy was a hell of a worker in his day, let me tell you.
Yeah. Why do you think his NWA title run was so brief?
Like I said, we had got away from the NWA, so I don't know politics. Who knows what it was about? The politics in this business is like any business. It's just it was politics there, so I don't really know how we got it or what happened.
Yeah. So last year, I just started binge-watching for hours Continental Wrestling Association, and one of the top Memphis, you know, promotions in the 80s. And it's where so many people that we know, as far as WWE stars, really had a chance to shine. And, you know, one of the best announcing teams was Lance Russell and Dave Brown. So how was
it
working? Absolutely. How was it working in the CWA?
Well, like you just said, Lance Russell and Dave Brown was a great team. There was no real big hype to them. They'd never been today, but they yell too loud. They want to be excited all the time. Lance and Dave never got excited, and I think that was the way they did it. And when I started, it takes a while to learn to do interviews. When I came here in 1975, you stutter and stammer, and Lawler was always a good talker, so I would be wrestling Lawler, and Lance would drag the interview out of me, so I take my hat off to him, and I thank him a lot for helping me in the first couple of years to do interviews, and Dave Brown same way. So to me, they were the two best. Now, Gordon Solie was very good, and Gordon knew all the holds. I mean, you know, he would say take the leg away and the chair will fall over and all that kind of thing. Take the head away and you can know it. He knew all that kind of stuff, I think, more than Lance did. But he was, you know, he was very good in his own right, and Lance and Dave was very good in their own right.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I really was I was just blown away by just the professionalism when I would hear some Memphis wrestling, and then, you know, Lance wrestled with his typical promotion, you know, during matches, you know, we got a Dandy in Evansville, you know, it's just,
yeah.
He
never got flustered.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, there'll be a couple of times where, you know, he'll have, you know, it'd be storyline purposes and he'll, you know, he'll have those moments where he kind of get off his rocker a little bit, but it just really fit so much into the program when he did make those moments, when he did have those moments, because, you know, it kind of drew heat to, you know, the heel at the time, you know, even to another level.
Here is the thing. Nobody talked like that back then. Nobody used them words to the announcer or said draw heat or do this or do that. You just went out and made an interview and he just talked all over what you was doing.
Right.
All this script writing bullshit that they're going on with today that Vince does, it's BS, man. I don't know. Well, that's what they say he does. I've never worked for the man, so I don't know. But we just went out and winged it all. Whatever I felt about Jerry Lawler, I said. Whatever he felt about me, he said. And Lance and Dave were in the middle to pick up the pieces and put them together. Makes sense to the wrestling fans, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and
we were very good at it.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, and it just seems like that kind of freestyle, you know, promo, you know, the promo cutting and just the talking
right
on the mic. It just seems like that type of freestyle.
Here is the difference of today and when what we did. There is no history with Vince McMahon's, with the WWE and the people in it. How long have they all been there? What is the longest anybody has been there? Hogan's gone. Stone Cold's gone. The Undertaker's gone. So there's no real history to talk about and say, well, I remember when I wrestled this guy, or I did this, or 2 years ago you did this, or 5 years ago you did this. There's no history. They're talking about it, so somebody writes it and tells them what to say.
Yeah.
And if they were all that good, they would all be in Hollywood. But they're not, so they're professional wrestlers. They're not, you know, and it's just all different kettle of fish to what we did, and we still kind of do it this way in Memphis, or we tried it, but there's no TV. But if any live shows we do, if you make an interview, there's history to talk about. There's no real history up there to talk about. I can go on. We talk about Jerry Lawler since 1975 to now.
Yeah.
And things that he's done, and I've seen him do, and what we've done and we haven't done. They can't do that adventure show. They haven't been around long enough. Jackie Fargo, you could talk about Jackie Fargo, you could talk about Don and Al Green. All the guys had been here for years, and new people would come in and leave. But you have the history.
Yeah, and a lot of times what I notice is that, a lot of times you don't get the people the opportunity to create, be their own person, you know what I mean, create their own character, because everything is just so kind of cookie cutter and kind of forced and kind of given to you. A lot of times nowadays compared to then, it's just you don't really get yourself an opportunity to shine and become your own person. Now, I think that's one of the biggest things. That,
I mean, I told the people I was 5'7", 210 pounds. I never tried to tell them I was 6'8", and 300 pounds. I was what I was, and the people bought into the story, the David and Goliath deal. And I kind of would sometimes use that, and I'd say, well, the first book they ever wrote was the Bible, and the story in that is David and Goliath, and David whopped Goliath, so size has nothing to do with it. And this is the South, the Bible Belt, and they buy that kind of stuff down here.
Yeah. I'm a man of cloth myself, so I agree with you.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. So, I mean, but see the history there? Everybody knows about David and Goliath.
Yep.
So if you talk about that, the kids learn about it in Sunday school and school and church and all the things, so they know the story.
Yep, and they can relate to it.
Yes, they can. And here's another thing. If you're driving down the street and you see a bigger guy and a smaller guy fighting, and you pull over to watch the fight, you'll end up cheering for the little guy and wish he wins.
Exactly.
That's just
exactly.
a natural reaction that we do for the underdog.
Yep, absolutely.
And
well
I was
said.
A good underdog in professional wrestling because I'm only 5'7", 210 pounds.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, watching, I've watched many, many, many matches that you've been in, and you did a really good job playing a babyface and a heel. So which one was better to you? Which one did you like playing better, the babyface or the heel?
I never really played any. When I was the bad guy, I was the bad guy. So, I mean, and when I'm the good guy, I want everybody to love me. When I don't want nobody to like me. So
yeah.
I would, my personality is more heelish. I'd as soon tell you to go jump in the lake as want to kiss you. You know what I mean? It's just that was my personality then. And as you get a little older, you soften up as the years go on. But I would rather be the bad guy.
Hmm. So there's been a speaking of CWA, and I've, like I said, I've watched many, many hours of CWA, specifically last year. I just, you know, I work out just about every day. And a lot of times when I go into the gym, I start off with about a half an hour cardio, half an hour, 45 minutes of cardio. And that's usually my time where I watch my wrestling history stuff. And I tell you what, man, just so many times within, you know, the gym, it becomes really my wrestling history haven because I watch stuff like CWA. And, you know, I watch many, you know, many matches that you were in and just how you were such a big name in CWA. And there were other names back then in the 80s, specifically the later 80s, 87, 88, 89, that really got some traction in the CWA. Names like The Undertaker, of course, you know, he wasn't The Undertaker at the time, but The Undertaker, Sid, Jeff Jarrett, Scott Steiner, Tracy Smothers, Harvey Whippleman, which was Downtown Bruno,
Bam
Bam
Bruno,
Bigelow,
yeah,
and other names. So how was it working with those names to know that a handful of them will be future Hall of Famers?
But there weren't names then. When
right.
Mean Mark Callis, The Undertaker, was Mean Mark Callis, he was just a big guy with freckles and red hair and a white skin. He never
yep.
looked nothing like The Undertaker until he got that gimmick from Vince McMahon. And, you know, he was a big old boy, but he didn't have the black hat and makeup on his face and rolling his eyes. That's what got him over as The Undertaker.
Yep.
If he'd been the same guy with red hair and freckles and white skin, do you think he would have got over?
Nope, I don't think so.
No, see
he
what
really
I'm saying?
Get over
so I knew
talent.
They were all coming in here when they first started.
Yeah.
They
yep.
didn't have no name recognition. The two names that they had to worry about here was Jerry Lawler and Bill Dundee. Because if you didn't work with him or me, you was in the first match.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We were the stars here.
How was it working with... Like, how was his backstage demeanor? Did he seem hungry? Because, you know, he's gotten so much respect as being one of the generals backstage in the WWE. How was it, you know, back in the late 80s working with someone like The Undertaker? Then, you know, he was just such a young kid at the time. But could you tell from his backstage and just his hunger, was there a drive that you can tell at that time even that this guy was destined to be a star?
Well, I don't think it's that. That doesn't work. If somebody don't make you one, you can't be one. It's the same as in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
You can be the best worker in the world, the best wrestler in the world, and if the office don't get behind you or the booker don't get behind you, you ain't going nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
they have to like you. Jerry Jarrett liked me and George Barnes when we come here, and he pushed us to the hilt. Then George went home, and he wanted me as a babyface, and he pushed me. So the two guys that he pushed was Lawler and Dundee. The rest were just here.
Mm-hmm.
I just watched the match. As a matter of fact, somebody sent it to my computer, me and Stone Cold, but he was stunning Steve Austin. They had long blonde hair today. And
yeah.
it was in Dallas. Yeah, you can see the part coming through. Well, this guy's got what it takes to do what we do.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't, you know, the Undertaker, when you're as big as him, you don't really have to have a lot of get up and go to you, you know, because your size gets you over just to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
When you're 5'7" and 200 pounds, you got to work a little harder than them big guys, let me tell you.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, that's great. Do you remember having specific conversations with him and just kind of giving him some pointers?
No, because Mark was the kind of guy that didn't really want any. And there was some like that. I was like that. If Jackie Fargo came up to me and told me something, that would be something. When I was in Australia, when Mark Loon and King Curtis and Skull Murphy and Brute Bernard and that crew back then would tell you something, because they were the stars in America and you'd read about them in the magazine and you knew who they were. They would come up and give you pointers, you would listen to him, but, you know, most guys that get in this business are egotistical to start with, and they really think they're better than everybody else, and there's only a couple of us that really are, as Jerry Lawler and me, with this territory.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but Mark was, he was pretty quiet, actually. He never said much to nobody. He just went and did his thing. Didn't, you know, tell him what you wanted, and he would do it. And then when he went to Vince, he became the Undertaker, and the rest is history. He's Vince's boy, so that's just how it is.
Yeah, absolutely. So you worked with, you had the opportunity to work with two promoters in the NWA, WCW territory. You worked with both with Jim Crockett and with Ted Turner when you were there. In the 90s when you were the manager of the Blue Bloods. So
no,
your time
Sir was, I was Sir William with Lord Stephen Regal.
With Lord Stephen Regal, yeah. With Stephen Regal.
Blue Bloods was Bobby Eaton and Stan Lane and Jim Cornette, I think, managed them.
Well, the Blue Bloods was William Regal and Squire David Taylor.
Then we made him Lord Regal. He wasn't getting over when he was just doing all them other gimmicks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So working with Jim Crockett, how was it working with you know Jim Crockett?
Well, he was actually working for Dusty. Dusty was the booker, and nothing happened that Dusty didn't want to happen. So it wasn't yet. The Crocketts may have paid you, but Dusty was the man, and I liked Dusty. I got along with him. I met him in Australia way back 40 years ago, so I knew him in Australia when him Dick Murdoch came to Australia as the Texas Outlaws. So I liked him, and I go over with him. And Dusty was, Dusty was going to look after Dusty, so as long as you knew what you was dealing with, it wasn't hard to figure around him.
Yeah.
You're not getting over him, let's put it that way.
And you work with them in Florida too, right?
Yeah, and I went to Florida, and we worked there, and then, but they were this. That's when Crockett had it.
Mm-hmm.
And then from Crockett, I went to Bill Watts first. When I booked Bill Watts' territory, Louisiana, it was the best 2 years he ever had in the history of his company.
Yeah.
I took Ricky
and
Robert, the Midnight Express, and Jim Cornette, Bill Dundee, Dutch Mantell, Buddy Landell. I took a great crew of boys down there. And they'd never seen the smaller guys in Louisiana because Watts used all the monsters because he's big. But we went down there, set the place on fire, and it was the two best years he ever had.
Yeah, absolutely. As far as Turner, you worked with Turner when you were Sir William managing Stephen Regal.
Yeah, well, that was... See, Bill Watts came in to take the book for Turner. And they went to a tour in England, and he saw Regal, and Regal could wrestle, and Watts likes wrestling, so he brought him over here. And they didn't know what to do with him. So Dusty Rhodes talked to me, and he said, what we do with this kid? I said, well, most Englishmen are lords. He said, well, let's make him Lord Stephen Regal, and we'll let Larry Sabisco manage him. And I said, Dusty, why would we put Larry Regal, he don't know nothing about lords in England. I'm from Scotland. We know that the British thing fits together. He said, okay, you manage him. So that's how it came. There was no thought given to it. There was nothing, no big deal to make it work. So I just wanted the job to be managing. I liked Steve, so I managed him, and then we kind of tried to help him out how the American style was from the English. So it's a little different.
Yeah.
But anyway, he got over, and he's still there, so... What can you say?
Yeah, he's one of the most respected people backstage from a wrestler, you know, from a wrestling standpoint because of his experience. So
well, I would imagine that, but most you can whoop most of them back there.
I've heard about that.
Working-wise, he ain't as near the worker Jerry Lawler is, but he's a whole different kind of, you know, he's a better shooter than Lawler. That kind, you see what I'm saying? So Regal can wrestle.
Yeah. Yeah, I heard about that. So I don't know if you are familiar with the incident that he had with Bill Goldberg during WCW time, but you know, Bill Goldberg's a big, intimidating guy, but he wrestled Regal, and he kind of got humbled a little bit with wrestling Regal. It's definitely been a very popular story of William Regal being one of the guys in the back that is a pretty good shoot fighter. So what caused
the most of them were like that, Billy Robinson, Tony Charles. I mean, you had to learn to wrestle, man. I learned to wrestle. I did judo, like I told you. We all did shoot things before we go in this business.
Yeah, yeah.
And Regal learned the old English style, too. The place called Wigan, he's about one of the last of them. That used to be the real bad place where all the shooters came from.
Mm-hmm.
And if you went there and you learned, that's where they taught you to shoot. And, you know, that doesn't happen today because it's a different world we live in.
Yeah.
But Regal would have been about one of the last of them.
So what caused
Billy Robinson was one. Tony Charles was one. They could all break your leg if they wanted to.
Yeah. Yeah, that'll humble you. What caused the split when you, you know, after you managed Regal, I believe he went to team with Eaton, with Bobby Eaton, and then eventually David Taylor, caused a split between you and the WCW at the time? Did they have, they didn't have anything else for you, or was it just a matter of just, you know, it was just time for you to go? You felt that you,
No, there was an idiot
who
came in and took over, and his name is Bischoff. Eric Bischoff took over, and he couldn't get himself lost in the, well, I was going to say, you know, can't cut, so can't say what I was going to say. But anyway, no, Bischoff never, I never got along with Bischoff or do the thing. I don't know how he got the job, but I do know how he got the job, but that's a different story, too. So anyway, I never cared for him. And then when Hogan came in, he kissed Hogan's backside and followed him around like a little lap dog. So he's not a very, very nice fella, I can tell you that much.
Wow. So did Bischoff let you go at the time? Was it he didn't see any use in you, unfortunately?
Well, he let me, Mike Graham, Greg Gagne, there's about four or five of us he let go at the same time. See, you had to have it was all done on a budget.
Mm-hmm.
So if you promised this guy X amount of dollars, you had to come up with the dollars. And if you say that whatever they were going to spend a year on wrestling, if you had already budgeted it out or spent it, you had to get rid of somebody to bring somebody else in, type thing. So he was spending money on Hogan and Randy Savage and all the guys that he thought were great. And I guess Mike Graham, Gagne's son, and me, he figured weren't worth the salt they were paying us. So they took the three checks that we got, put it into one, and give it to somebody else. Now that's the story I got. So
yeah. Yeah, it's pretty unfortunate. Yeah, that's pretty unfortunate. I interviewed Greg Gagne a couple times last year. Yeah, he's one of the friends of the show, and just some amazing stories that were shared by Greg, and he mentioned that as well, just as far as just a kind of underhanded tactic that he experienced as well. So I can definitely, you know, see that. Yeah. Was it?
That's a true story. There's none of us making that up. That actually happened.
Yeah, yeah. That's definitely pretty tough. So, did you have any desire to work for Vince McMahon at all?
You would have to say you'd be an idiot if you said no. I went up to his big house up in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
Had lunch with him and his family. And there was a little ice hockey guy there that worked in his office. Springer. What the hell was his name? Can't think of his name. Anyway, the Pat Patterson was there, and I knew Pat Patterson, Australia, and I got along good with Pat. So, and then Vince was there, and his wife was there. Shane was just a young guy, and the girl was just little. What's her name? Stephanie?
Mm-hmm.
She's just a little bitty thing then when I went up there 25 years ago or whenever it was. And it just never worked out, let's put it that way.
Yeah, that's. I definitely think that he could have been a pretty established manager. I think your Sir William, gimmick was pretty good at the time, because you know you had so much tenure in the wrestling business at that time, you know, and becoming a manager was a pretty good idea. So you have a book, and I'm going to read a quote from the book and you know, get your thoughts on it. I had a chance to read a bit of it. And so let the listeners know what the title of your book is. What is it, you know, what is it about, and where can they find it?
Well, the title of the book is, if you don't want the answer, don't ask the question. And that comes from type of a wrestling type thing. Because most of the young guys will come up to you and say, did you watch my match? How was my match? They want you to tell them, blow smoke and tell them how great they were. Well, most of the time, if I think it sucks, I will tell you that it sucks. So that's why I say, if you don't want the answer, pal, don't ask me the question, because I'm going to give it to you. So that's how the book is all kind of like that. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And where can they find it?
Well, hang on here a minute. I have a website. Isn't that awful? That is the thing with lovely voices.
Mama? Yeah. I know Amazon has it. That's where I got it from.
Tell that young man what his name's, Chris.
Hey, Chris.
Hi. How are you?
Our website is www.BillSuperstarDundeeEnterprises.com.
Awesome. Again, listeners, that is www.BillSuperstarDundeeEnterprises.com.
.com, yes.
Fantastic. And are you Bill's wife?
Yes.
Awesome. And your name?
My name is Donna.
Awesome. Well, great talking to you.
Great talking to you, Chris.
Thank you.
Here's
very much.
Bill.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
Awesome.
All right. So,
yeah.
Terrible.
So,
you can't remember your own website, but I don't do much on that computer anymore. But the one I use every day, it's lit.
Yeah.
So I may do that one, but I never do nothing with the book. She does all that. And I think Amazon sells them in a few other places.
Yeah, that's where
like
I learned from.
But if anybody goes to that website, you can see what we sell. We got videos and all kinds of things, T-shirts, just like everybody else.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've been there, and definitely some great paraphernalia. So you, one of the quotes that you have on the book says, "Today I hear fans complain there are not the characters in wrestling like they used to be. And to be honest, I think they're right." So, I definitely pulled that quote out from reading. I definitely pulled that quote up because I see so much of that in today's wrestling culture. So, and you kind of talked about a little bit earlier in the interview as far as, you know, just the kayfabe being so real back in the day and characters being kind of larger than life. What do you think the issue is? You kind of mentioned as far as, you know, everything's scripted and just kind of handed to you and kind of Vince McMahon, and that's the Vince McMahon way as far as these days. Why do you think that's the case? Is it just a matter of, you know, things being so concentrated on sponsors and stockholders that the characters don't really have an opportunity to kind of translate?
Well, right, and they're not around long enough, some of them. But here's the other thing. Vince wants to own everything. So if he makes you Donald Duck, he owns Donald Duck. If
That's
he makes
true.
You Daffy Duck, He owns Daffy Duck. See what I'm saying? Whatever name he gives the Undertaker, unless he gives Vince McMahon, gives Mark the rights to use it, he can't do nothing with it once he leaves Vince.
Yeah.
Now, I think Stone Cold used his own thing. That was Stone Cold. Vince didn't own that.
Yeah.
The Austin deal. But if he owns the gimmick, it belongs to him.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
And I think a lot of it has to do with that. But like I said, I never quite got the work of the man. I went up and talked to him. It never quite worked out, but that's another story.
Yeah.
So,
going back, you know, you've been in the business, what, 35, 40 years now?
Well, I started in 1962.
Ooh, so that's 54 years. Fantastic. That is
maybe a little more
than
that. Well, I'm 72 now, so I was 18 when I started, something like that. So,
yeah, it's 54 years. That is 52 years. Yeah, that's you say you're 72 now. You were 18. Yeah, sort of.
Yeah,
54 years. That is quite. Yes. Yeah, speaking of that, it's a great segue to what I was about to say. So you still wrestling part time. So I saw that you wrestled in 2001, you wrestled in 2007, and you wrestled in a couple times in 2013. And recently at WrestleCade in 2015, you were a part of a battle royal. What is it about just the pro wrestling business that just even at 72 years old, just makes you keep going? Is it just that crave that you'll, you know, there's been many wrestlers that, you know, said that, you know, you'll never retire. You know, once you're a wrestler, you always have that itch and you'll never retire. I've heard that from some legendary wrestlers before. And what is it about,
yeah,
you know, kind of your fix?
Well, I still wrestle every weekend. I do Friday and Saturday, sometimes Thursday, Friday and Saturday, but I usually wrestle three times a week, at least two. And the other thing is, I watch 72-year-old men walk down the street, and I think, if anybody wanted to take that man's wallet, it wouldn't be hard. Well, jump on me and try to take mine and see how hard it's going to be if you don't have a gun. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I do it to go to the gym and work out and still lift weights, ride my bike and wrestle to kind of stay in shape and look after myself.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a great point, actually. It's at 72, you know, it's That's some really good training. That's a really good defense training as well. So the winner of that battle royal, EC3, Ethan Carter III, actually won that battle royal. And he's, you know, we kind of talk about the WWE kind of owning things. He was Derek Bateman in the WWE, didn't really have an opportunity to shine. Went to TNA and became one of the most polarizing stars in the history of TNA as EC3. How was it working with him?
What's his real name?
Ethan Carter. Well, his Ethan Carter III is his actual, you know, stage name at this point. His real name, I don't remember. It's Michael Hutter.
His name.
Michael Hutter is his name. His real name.
Yes. I mean, when you're just in one battle royal, it's just like you're in, you're out, you're gone, and I haven't seen him before or since. So you know what I mean? It wasn't really. No, nobody got hurt. That's the main thing. Nobody did nothing stupid in the royal. But so,
yeah,
that's the other thing I was telling you. He went to Vince and never set the woods on fire. Then he went over to TNA or wherever you said he went, and they pushed him real hard, and he got over like a house of fire. See what I'm saying? If the office don't push you or want you to get over, you can't get over.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, again, you know what you're saying is very true as far as just ownership and wanting. You know, if you're Daffy Duck, you better start quacking. Unfortunately,
right. And when I was the booker, I mean, Ricky and Robert were friends of mine, which was great. The Rock and Roll Express, Cornette, Bobby Eaton's my son-in-law, Dennis Garner was a friend of mine. We all went to Watts' territory and set the place on fire. It never made as much money or saw them guys like them ever. Bill Watts just used big monster guys like Jim Duggan and Butch Reed. Not saying that they can't wrestle, but they were big, slow, and cumbersome. You know what I mean? They weren't little guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when we went down there, it just was all new. They were over like rock stars, I'm telling you.
Absolutely.
Ricky and Robert was unbelievable.
Oh, goodness, yeah. The Rock and Roll Express is one of the best of all time, for sure. Way over in the South. So my last question to you, Bill, is what is one thing in professional wrestling that you wish you achieved but never did?
Nothing. I came to be in Memphis, and when I came to Memphis and liked it and got over in the South and done everything, worked with world's champions, worked with tag team champions, nothing. It's been very good to me.
Awesome.
So being in it since 1962 to now and still doing it in 72 years young, I still enjoy doing it. Can you do what you did when you're 30? No, you can't do when you did you're 30 when you're 70. But I still have fun doing it, and I still don't get bored with it. And I haven't really, I never really wanted to be the world's champion. I never really wanted, Laura and I were the AWA tag champs. So I've kind of set all my goals. I mean, I made a good living for 40, 50 years, so what can I say?
Awesome. You were also champion OVW as well, so you got to wrestle, you know, some of the names that are interact with some of the names that we see in the WWE now.
Yeah, well, Danny Davis runs the OVW when he was doing that. And he asked me 30 years ago, he said, you need to move to Louisville. We'll open the wrestling school in Monroe. I said, Danny, I'm not moving. Anyway,
yeah.
he hooked up with Vince, made a lot of money, but that was all right. But I've never really wanted to do any more than did. The only bad thing that I think I should have done, I should have went to Hollywood. But we all thought of that when we were younger and getting the movies, but we didn't. So I was doing good wrestling, so we never went. But the ones that went, Stone Cold, The Rock, and all the people to see just how good wrestlers are.
Oh, yeah. Especially The Rock. The Rock is...
doing other stuff. Oh, yeah. Dewey used to come to my house when he was just a little bitty fella.
Nice.
And Jamie used to play together. Rocky Johnson and I were tag team champions here, so...
Huh. So any...
He's a real good guy, too, Dwayne. He's a real, real good guy.
Yeah. Any stories that you can remember as Rock as a little kid?
We're Rocky and Dwayne, he was just a little fella then, Rocky. So I had a dirt bike. So Rocky Johnson says, "I'm going to get a dirt bike. There's a guy down the road for you want to sell one." So anyway, he went there and he bought it. So comes back. We're in the field at the back of my house. So Dwayne's there and Jamie's there and me. So Rocky cranks the bike up and it's starting to get dark. So. Just takes off on the bike, just lets the clutch out and takes off. He's riding it around this field. So Dwayne says to me, "How are we going to get my dad off that bike?" I said, "What do you mean, how are we going to get your dad off the bike?" He said, "He's never rode one before. He just got on it and took off on the thing. He doesn't know what the brake is, the clutch is, or none of that." So anyway, when he slowed down, come by, I said, "Rock, put left here, lever in, put your foot on that little knob there. That's the brake." So anyway, we got the thing stopped with a dirt bike. So Dewey was saying, "Well, tell him how to get off."
Wow. That's incredible. That's great. Awesome, man. Well, Bill, I appreciate your time, man. It's been a great time chatting with you. Again, for all the listeners, as his wife said, it's www.billsuperstardundeeenterprises.com. where you can find all the paraphernalia. Are you into Facebook? Do you have a Facebook page?
Yeah, I got a Facebook page. Now, how do you get on it? I don't know.
You know. So you're
B Dundee. My website. If you want to email me, it's bdundee88@gmail.com. So it's bdundee88@gmail.com. So
once
if you
again,
send me an email and you want something, I'll get back with you to call you. I like to do telephone calls, so I usually like to give people my number. So
yeah,
it's easier for me to talk. I guess, 72. That's what we did all with life, right? Talked on the telephone.
No, the telephone doesn't. Any damn thing you want to do. Take your picture, video, you do whatever.
Absolutely, yeah. Do you text? I know that, you know, we've talked on the phone a couple times, you know, before this interview, but most of our conversations have been through texting. Do you text a lot?
Oh, yeah, I'll text. You know, I mean, if I think it's important enough, I would text you back. But if it's just somebody saying, what are you doing, they're lucky able to get an answer. Don't have time to text.
Well, I should feel special because you text me
back. If it's business, I'll text you back. Like you said, we'll call in at 8 o'clock or 10 o'clock. Yeah, I'll text you back on that. But
yeah, awesome. Well, I appreciate you, man. I appreciate you taking your time speaking with you. I'm honored and privileged to speak to such a legend, sir.
All right, Chris, I appreciate it, and good luck to all your listeners out there, and I hope you buy the book, and if you buy it, it's the best one out there, I promise you, any one of them videos. So, Chris, if you ever need it again, give me a holler, okay?
Awesome, I appreciate it. Thanks a lot, man.
All right, mate, take care. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Bring what you got. The measuring stick just changed around here, buddy. You're looking at it.
Four corners, free. Our mind. Let's go. The whole squad is making it clear, we taking this year. You know who we are, but you don't know why we here. So this is where the big boys play. These big boys play like who defies the living God. Get out the big boys way. Outsiders with the swoop in, we live as kings. You see in us, but our third man waits in the wings. And when the time is right, we shock him with the proper attack. I go for Dolo, but ain't solo, cut the promo in black. Hollywood, Hendrix, Frizzle, pinning them to the mat.
And I'm Das Wunderkin with the strength of 100 men, with one intent, to see the will fulfilled of the one who sent his son to give himself. But you rap about your gas and your rags torture, white coffins when I drop a bomb. My mic's awesome, never lost faith. You in all space, you can all skate, suffer but never crippled. No bin walls in my cross face. From here to Saturday, raving, anticipating. I was frostbit, now I am glacier, mixed with some Vader. Get to hawking with these animals, you and God for my defense. In Alabama, we jamming. That's beautiful. Bobby Eaton, me and Priest, we the dangerous alliance. Nah, the Harlem Heat. Tie the do-rag before we do battle. You're talking sheep. You all what you speak. This too sweet.
Till the genre is took back, we repping that wolf pack. The foundation shaking, no mistaking. Yeah, we shook that. Trust in God, we trust. Pushing forward, never look back. Meekness ain't at all weakness. Some people mistook that. Stamping out this crook rap. He turning the power on the razor's edge, leg drop after a power bomb. Tired of the lies, man, we bringing the truth through. Diligent and fruitful, the owners in our group too. It's good to be king, sold out, this war is brutal.
We playing them war games, our army go move too. You through, I'm in the Raptors with a bat in my hand, and stand to shatter all your plans so they don't matter. In the grand scheme, it's that easy. We tag teaming, Steiner brothers, we love it. Demand the win, establish it. This the clash of the champions.
This is where the big boys play, huh? We ain't here to play.
Indeed, 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 ladies and gentlemen. That was a great interview by superstar Bill Dundee. Like I said before, man, it's awesome. It's always awesome. Get some road stories and just speak to some legends, man. The guy's been in the business for 50 plus years, and he's 72 years young, spending his time to speak to the Pancakes and Power Slam show. It's just, I mean, I'm humbled by it. I'm humbled by it. It's just awesome to speak to someone that's been through it all. He's been through generations, you know, he's been through two generations of professional wrestling, and it's just great. And now he uses professional wrestling as a, kind of a defense, kind of a martial art, is even to a sense that he uses it for, and it's great, you know. So every 72-year-old wrestler out there, wrestle three times a week, gets, you know, keep your endurance and your cardiovascular skills up, and you know, now it's a good defense mechanism. It's a good training tactic for him. That's awesome. It really is. So I appreciate the superstar Bill Dundee on the show. So with the Crave Wrestling Facebook page, you know, with Crave Wrestling is the is who we are, and it's the culture, it's the Facebook page, and it's really the culture of this movement that I founded years ago, and it's continuing to grow and grow and grow. So we have some announcements coming up the pike. We got some amazing interviews, including next week we got another another legend, another general of professional wrestling. We got none other than Teddy Long. So really, really looking forward to Teddy Long interview. It's going to be an amazing, amazing show. But, you know, we started this Facebook Live a few weeks back, continuing to have all types of support, and you guys are just absolutely amazing with the sharing your thoughts on Facebook Live, and it's just really, really a great time. So I really appreciate you all and continuing to do that. So we talked about Payback. I talked about Payback, my thoughts on Payback. I also talked about my thoughts on Raw, as I do every Monday with the Raw review. After the on Facebook Live every Monday, and also with pay-per-views. So I shared a lot with Payback. So, you know, as far as getting into it a whole lot tonight, I'll get into it some, and I'll also get into Raw a bit. I want to spend a lot about a chunk of the rest of the show on Ryback. I'm really interested to speak about that. And also the favorite of the week today is the AWA World Tag Team Champions, who end up winning a singles title in the WWE. So that'll be very interesting statistics at the time to talk about. All right, so with Payback, speaking of Ryback, the kickoff with Ryback, and I talked about this on Sunday evening, I really thought that this is one of the best segments of the entire pay-per-view. I was really, really amazed by Ryback's heelish antics. I absolutely adored it. It was amazing. You know, the whole on the knee, the looking at the watch, the it's clobbering time. It was absolutely amazing. And Ryback, you know, for a while now, Ryback has been pretty notorious with ribbing CM Punk. And we saw it, and it was great, and just kind of mocking him even. And it was just absolutely amazing to see that. Juice so much heat in Chicago, and it was really, really awesome to see and experience. Yeah, I was really drawn into that. From the very beginning, that was the first thing that Ryback did. I mean, it was the first way to be introduced into the Payback show, with the exception of, before that was Dolph Ziggler and Baron Corbin, which I just don't understand it. I really don't understand it. It gets so frustrating to me to see someone who just simply does their job, and Baron Corbin as a heel, he does it well. He does it very well. There's not many, I've said this before, there's not many pure heels left in the WWE. A lot of the heels, they're liked because of their wrestling ability, because they're an indie guy, they're liked, so they're heels, but a lot of times they're only heels because they wrestle good guys, they wrestle baby faces, and they try to act as if they're heels, but they don't really translate that toward the audience because the audience love them. You know, people like the Seth Rollins of this world and the Kevin Owens of this world, they are heels technically, but they're so good and they're so well known from their indie background that they get cheered. I love pure heels because they're really good at being a heel and they legitimately get booed. Baron Corbin is the last of a dying breed. He is a pure heel who gets heat, really, really good heat. And he's so good, and he gets so much amazing heat. The only thing that he has to do is spread his arms, and he gets heat. He gets boos by simply spreading his arms, looking to the crowd. That is really, really amazing, an amazing quality that the WWE is just totally glossing over. Now, why are they glossing over it? Because they had Dolph Ziggler, someone who has not been relevant since he, unfortunately, and this is unfortunate because they really had an opportunity to do some really, really good things and draw some good money with Dolph Ziggler. Unfortunately, he got his concussion, and so there's been, you know, time after time where someone would get a concussion and the WWE would just kind of backpedal on giving that person a push. Of course, we saw that with Dolph Ziggler. We saw it with Daniel Bryan. And since then, it just seems like he was never, you know, pinned to be the guy or someone relevant anymore. So it's unfortunate for Ziggler, but he really don't have much of a future from a relevant standpoint in the WWE period. And for some reason, Baron Corbin wins the Andre the Giant Memorial Battle Royal. And he gets placed into a feud with Dolph Ziggler, who is not over enough to really put Corbin over. And I've said this before. You're not getting over if you're beating someone who's not over. You're just, I mean, that's just horrible logic. There's no way. That's the reason why I was so dissatisfied with Chris Jericho's run for so many times, because he loses so many feuds that he's not really putting people over if he keeps losing. And same thing with Kane. Same right now, it's with Dolph Ziggler. He's so 50-50. He'll win one, lose one. And that's not a strong character. That's not a strong wrestler to put someone against to in the attempts to get over. I would have even, see, here's my thing. And you don't have many choices right now of someone who's a solid babyface who has enough steam right now in order to get him over. And out of the selections that they have, and I wish, you know, maybe they're doing this. Corbin needs to beat someone to get over. I would love to see Baron Corbin and Randy Orton have a feud and Orton put Corbin over. I think that would be an amazing thing to do. Orton versus Corbin at SummerSlam. Orton puts Corbin over. There's absolutely nothing left for Randy Orton to do in the WWE. Orton is someone who doesn't lose often. So he could put a heel over and someone who's trying to go to that next level. Randy Orton is the perfect person to do that. He could put that person over because he's been protected most of his career in the WWE as a main eventer. He's been protected for the most part. So you can give him that person to actually put over because he has a pretty good win-loss record. Baron Corbin's that guy. Baron Corbin's the guy that you could use, that you can ascend to that next level with being in a feud with Randy Orton. And even before then, you know, I would even have a program with Kane. Kane is a good choice to, you know, for Baron Corbin to defeat. Like I said, unfortunately, Kane, his name isn't strong enough because of his win-loss record. But Kane's an anomaly. You know, I mentioned people like Jericho. Jericho's not an anomaly. He looks like a normal guy. He's an amazing, he's one of the best wrestlers of all time, in my opinion. Definitely the best in the world at what he does. Do you understand what I'm saying to you right now? But he's not, Jericho's not an anomaly. Kane, yes, he's an anomaly. He's just a big red monster that comes out with fire. So, unfortunately, his name isn't strong, isn't very strong, because his booking over the years have been so lackluster as a whole. However, he has that anomaly factor that if Baron Corbin defeats him, it will really help Corbin ascend to someone, an even stronger babyface like Randy Orton. But you messed it up because you had Dolph Ziggler beat Baron Corbin. His first match, you're building up Corbin. You're having him attack Ziggler. We're thinking, yeah, he's just going to plow through Ziggler and on to the next person. But nope, that's not what happened. He loses against Dolph Ziggler, someone who hasn't been a strong babyface almost ever. He turned not too long after he won the world title. Then he was important, but Ziggler, I mean, you know, when Sting debuted, when he was on Team Cena, he was a sole survivor. That was a good spike in his career, but never really been consistently important. Now he beats Baron Corbin, and now, you know, it just seems like a rug was pulled underneath Corbin. Of course, you know, he can rebound from that. He's going to be there for a while. It seems like Corbin's going to be, you know, he's maybe one of the guys that they're looking at to make important and make one of those strong heels. But you just can't do that. You can't have someone lose and win and lose and win and expect for this person to have enough steam and enough strength to be relevant. I mean, it's just logic. I mean, that's what I don't understand with these booking teams. It's the logic of the business. You build up the heel. You build up the heel strong enough. You give him all the heat you can, just bursting with heat. Give him all the heat. Have him win some pivotal matches. Have him create some shock. Have him make disappoint the crowd going home that night, just shaking their head because the heel won, beat the big guys, you know, just made some type of presence to build and draw heat. So when that heel draws that heat and builds up enough heat, then that's when you put over the babyface. You have him lose to the good guy. Simple logic. I've been watching wrestling over 30 years, and that's what I've learned. That's what I've learned to be successful. That's why people like Sting is one of the best of all time, because one of the best heels of all time, Ric Flair, he would lose, yes, but at the same time, he was such a good heel because he was the champ. He was the best in the business at drawing heat. He was good on the mic. He had henchmen in the Four Horsemen. Three other people in the Four Horsemen. He had that mentality to say he was like a godfather type of character. You know, he was kind of like the mouthpiece, and he was the spearhead of, he was kind of the leader. It was kind of an even plane, but we knew that Flair was the leader. Flair was the man. He was the world champion. And he knew how to draw heat. He knew how to win matches and draw enough heat winning those matches. You know, he'll beat Dusty. He'll beat Nikita. He'll beat TA. You know, he'll beat these notable names to set him up for that one guy to set him up for Sting at Clash of the Champions, to set him up for Luger, to set him up for these big names, for this whatever big heel, whatever big babyface you wanted to be over at the time. You had Ric Flair get enough heat to lose to the babyface. Simple stuff. But nowadays, nope, somehow we're supposed to believe in a character that loses to someone who's been irrelevant for years. Come on now, just ridiculous. Same thing with Kalisto and Ryback. You're coming to tell me that at WrestleMania, on the pre-show, he loses to Kalisto, someone who is just a jacked up behemoth and could beat Kalisto with blindfolds on, one hand tied behind his back. We're supposed to believe. I know, of course, it's wrestling. We're suspending reality. I get it. But at the same time, give the guy some heat. Losing match after match, that doesn't give you any heat. Yeah, I know that he beat him on SmackDown last week or a couple of weeks ago in order to get him this match, you know, at Payback. But you don't. I mean, it's just ridiculous. I don't understand that. And, of course, you know, he wrote the blog, and I thought the blog was very poignant. I thought it was very meaningful. If you've been living under a rock in the wrestling world, there's some issues going on with Ryback and Vince McMahon at the point of time. And check out his blog. He you know, lays it out very articulately. And I think he did a good job. And I think, you know, it's something that should be heard. He should. There's so many times when you're interviewing in the wrestling world, you can't say what you really want to say. That's why people like Damian Sandow, you probably won't get any interviews from him because he just continues to lose. Speaking of Baron Corbin, he put Baron Corbin over on SmackDown. So it's just, you know, someone who's like someone like Damian Sandow who, you know, he's cheered by the fans, but that didn't make any difference. He's not one of the people that we want to push, so be it. Just, I don't get it, man. I really don't understand. Kalisto's not over. Kalisto's not a championship material. Kalisto's a failed project, just like his partner Sin Cara. And I like Sin Cara. I like Hunico as Sin Cara better than Mystico, because to me, Hunico's a big guy. I mean, he's I don't think people understand how much of a nice, you know, a decent size Hunico is as Sin Cara, that, you know, he's bigger than a lot of, you know, champions. You know, just pay attention to Sin Cara when you know, next time he wrestles. He's a big guy. I mean, you know, he flies around everywhere, so he's booked as a luchador and a cruiserweight or a light heavyweight, but, you know, he's a pretty decent sized guy that, you know, can be a marketable mid card champion. I think Sin Cara would have been a more realistic option for me to be a mid card champ, but, you know, I understand that they were trying to, you know, spread the demographic and kind of, I get it I'm a PR major. That's my undergrad's in PR. So I get what you're trying to do from a branding and PR standpoint. You're trying to widen your audience at that time in order to, you know, probably book some dates and some shows. Something like that. I understand it. But Kalisto's not the guy. Kalisto was never the guy. I gave him a shot just because I didn't want to be pessimistic when it came to him winning the title. But it was a bad idea from the start. Now you had Rusev beating him. I mean, you know, winning the number one contender match, the number one contender U.S. Battle Royal match. I really hope that they book I really hope that they do that with Rusev. I really hope that Rusev finally gets an opportunity again to become relevant. Because after his loss against John Cena at 31, no good. Not very relevant at all. Feuding with Dolph Ziggler and Summer Rae and Lana and when he, you know, there was time, there was some funny times when he was with Summer Rae. He had an opportunity to kind of expand his character, add some more layers on his character a bit. That was funny. But that's just not Rusev. I mean, as much as I was enjoying it, that's not Rusev. And now I think getting back to the whole Bulgarian brute, I think that gives him an opportunity to just kind of finally make him a strong heel again, because they need strong heels. They had an opportunity to do it with Ryback, failed miserably. Had an opportunity to do it with Baron Corbin, not doing it very good at all. So maybe Rusev's the guy again. Maybe give Kalisto just needs to get rid of the U.S. title because it hasn't been relevant in quite some time. And that's really unfortunate, too, because, you know, last year, was it SummerSlam or, yeah, I think it was SummerSlam, that they had the match between the title versus title match between Seth Rollins and John Cena. Now, that the U.S. title was just as big and just as important as the world title. And Cena's more over than Rollins. So a lot of times the U.S. title was bigger. Yeah, it was SummerSlam last year. Title for title match. Seth Rollins won. And I believe, the next month was Sting, Night of Champions. Yeah, it's, you know, it was very, very important. I think it was Rollins versus Sting for the World Championships. I think he lost the title. Rollins lost the title not too long after that, but I mean, it was a really good stipulation to it. They were really putting some time in Seth Rollins. But they need some more heels. They definitely need some stronger heels because it's just really hard to endure. And Titus O'Neil appears in the Battle Royal. I don't know. I'm not one to be a big conspiracy theorist, but it just seemed to me that plugging Titus O'Neil in that spot was a way to kind of hurry up and sneak him in, so he doesn't get that big pop that people were waiting to give him. And unfortunately, this is back to the drawing board. He's going to be fairly relevant mid-carder once again, just where he left off, feuding with Stardust and just total irrelevancy. And it's sad, too, because Titus is a pretty good mid-card hand. I think he's better as a babyface because I think the heel Titus didn't really resonate very well. But back to the drawing board. They're not going to do anything with Titus O'Neil. There are so many reports of and so many beliefs by fans that they're going to use this as an opportunity to build Titus O'Neil and he'll get this huge pop when he comes back. Nope. He was a part of the Battle Royal and not so much. So it's unfortunate that he came back that way. Real quick, we'll talk about AJ Styles and Roman Reigns. Before that, I want to talk about Jericho and Ambrose a little bit. It's hard for me to just really endure this because I said this before. I don't think Rollins beating Jericho moves the needle for Ambrose. I don't believe that Ambrose defeating Jericho moves the needle for Ambrose at all. Because one, Jericho, they're building him a little stronger this run. Beating AJ was a shocker, but at least, you know, he kind of broke the mold of knowing that he's going to lose. So at least that was, you know, that shock factor was good. I was a fan of it. It didn't make much sense in the long run, but I was a fan of it. You know, if anything, it gave him some steam to put over Ambrose. But, you know, that match at Payback was just really lackluster. It was hard to really get into. I really didn't enjoy it that much. Now it seems like we're going to get some type of Extreme Rules match. It just seems like they're just regurgitating matches from Payback to Extreme Rules, which is WWE. Hey, they've got the network, so they can do that as much as they want. Most people want to unsubscribe anyway, so it really doesn't matter. Which is a sad concept, because you're doing it to keep the loyalty of your fans. If it wasn't for the fans, if it wasn't for they kept throwing the number 1.8 million, if it wasn't for those 1.8 million people, your boys wouldn't be able to get paid. Saw an article that the average wrestler makes $500,000 a year. I quickly went over and chatted with one of my buddies who was a former WWE wrestler, a former established WWE wrestler, and he said, "Oh no, that's not true. $100,000, maybe $120,000, but an upper echelon makes the big money. But other than that, nope, that's a very embellished number," which I thought. But yeah, I just with Jericho and Ambrose, I just don't see it, man. I don't see the money. And unfortunately, I just don't. It's unfortunate. It's really, really unfortunate. Who managed Power and Glory? There's my trivia question for tonight. Who managed Power and Glory? And finally, with Ambrose, with AJ Styles and Roman Reigns, that match at Payback was absolutely amazing. And I knew it was going to be. And for those who say that Roman Reigns can't wrestle, you should stop watching wrestling. You should probably get your fix on MMA or something like that. I don't know. But I mean, it's just trolling. It's just ridiculous, blindless, mindless trolling. Blinding and mindless trolling to say that Roman Reigns can't wrestle. He's proved time and time again. Now, if this was about 2 years ago when he was feuding with Randy Orton, I'd be willing to listen to your argument. Nowadays, absolutely not. Four and four-plus star matches with Big Show. Of course, his match with Daniel Bryan was absolutely amazing. Even his tournament match, his world title tournament match against Cesaro, was really good. Matches with Alberto Del Rio were good. His match on SmackDown against Del Rio was good. Even when he went against The Miz on SmackDown last weekend was pretty good. I mean, Roman Reigns gives it his all. He's a really good worker. He's improved leaps and bounds better. So it's really hard for me to listen to someone who does that. They just probably want to put themselves over because they spend their time looking at screens and typing their feelings away. Extreme Rules to be a pretty good match between AJ and Roman Reigns. We'll see how it translates. At the end of the day, you know, we're going to get something. You know, I was predicting a swerve at Payback. We may get it at Extreme Rules. There has to be some type of payoff to these attacks by Anderson and Gallo. So, you know, we'll see the payoff. We'll eventually see it. So it'll be interesting. Holding Triple H off of TV is good, too, because I think it gives him time to gives us time to continue the suspense. And, you know, we'll probably see a Shane McMahon Triple H match coming up the pike, which I think would be a very good match. So we'll see. Flavor of the week time. Here we go.
It is now time for the flavor of the week.
All right, so I compiled a list of AWA Tag Team Champions or NAWA Tag Team Champion who eventually won a singles title in the WWE. Pretty interesting list. There's a there's six people that achieves this. Well, yeah, six people. So in 1978, Pat Patterson won the AWA Tag Team title with Ray Stevens, the Crippler. Ray Stevens, September 23rd, 1978. A year later, he would become Intercontinental Champion. Aha, very interesting. 1983, Ken Patera won the AWA Tag Team titles with Jerry Blackwell as the Sheiks. He actually did most of his work in the, with the Heenan family, with Bobby Heenan. And yeah, I believe it was 1980 that Ken Patera won the Intercontinental title. And he also was tag team champ. So June 26, 1983 with the Sheiks, and then. Yes, the 1980s is when he won the Intercontinental Championship. And then he won it with the tag team title with Brad Riggins as the Olympians on May the 25th of 1989. So he actually used his – this was kind of like the reverse. He actually used his height, the height of his career in 1980, winning the Intercontinental Championship, to use that to become a notable name with the AWA. 1986, we saw Scott Hall and Curt Hennig win the AWA Tag Team Championships. And, of course, both of them would become Intercontinental Champions in the WWE as Mr. Perfect Curt Hennig and Razor Ramon. And both of them are in the WWE Hall of Fame. Marty Jannetty and Shawn Michaels is the last two. As the Midnight Rockers, they won the AWA Tag Team Championships on January 27th, 1987. And once again, the same day in December in 1987 as well. And both of them would go on to become Intercontinental Champions. And, of course, Shawn Michaels, WWE Hall of Famer, one of the greatest of all time, multi-time WWE World Heavyweight Champion. So, interesting list for today. I thought it was something different and something very apropos to the AWA tag team scene. Bill Dundee, thank you, man. 72 years young, talking about some wrestling on the Pancakes and Power Slam show. It doesn't get any better than that. Next week, Teddy Long will be on the show. I'm really, really excited about that. We're going to have some amazing stories for Teddy Long. Until next week, you all have a wonderful, wonderful week. Enjoy your week of wrestling, and God bless you all. But goodbye.